You're listening to a New York Sports Nation production,
enhancing your New York sports fan experience.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city.
Welcome to a special one-part series by Tim LaDuca, focusing on baseball in Mexico, how a sport shaped an identity. Fernando Mania, the 1981 Major League Baseball season, where a 20-year-old left-handed pitcher from Mexico named Fernando Valenzuela won the Cy Young and Rookie of the Year award, actually started in 1980. Fernando Valenzuela was called up to the majors on September 15, 1980, and he pitched 17 and two-thirds innings without letting up an earned run. After the subsequent 1981 season, where, quote, Valenzuela's cashable celebrity opened America's eyes to the idea of marketing Hispanic players to a Latino audience hungry for their own likeness, according to a Sports Illustrated article written by Luis Llosa, Valenzuela then appeared in five more All-Star games, struck out 2,074 batters, and won 165 games in the major leagues. Then he'd play two seasons from 2006 to 2008 at the ages of 45 and 46 in the Mexican League for the Aguilas de Mexicali. Fernando's career is not the only notable product of Mexican baseball. There is Angel Macias and the 1957 Little League World Series champions from Monterrey, Mexico. There is over 120 Mexican-born major leaguers, beginning with Mel Almada in 1933 and all the way up to Andrés Muñoz, who debuted with the San Diego Padres in July of 2019. But there is also a larger idea at play here, of course, because why else would I record a podcast about it? After a complex and undefined beginning of baseball in Mexico, official Mexican baseball took off in the 1920s after the Mexican Revolution, revealing Mexico's quest to develop and solidify their national identity. This podcast will trace Mexico's search and creation for an identity from the Porfiriato in the late 1800s up to the present day through the lens of baseball. Before we really dive in, I'd like to thank Cassidy Lent, the manager of reference services at the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, for helping me with this project. She provided me with many helpful sources and also helped me get in touch with John O'Dell, the curator of history and research at the Hall of Fame. At the conclusion of this episode, Mr. O'Dell joins me for an interview about baseball in Mexico in the Viva Baseball exhibit at the Hall of Fame. Let's get started. Before taking a look at the effect baseball had in shaping Mexico's identity, we should probably look at Mexico's identity and how they created it as a whole. According to Zahra Moss, the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago was a chance for Mexicans to, quote, sharpen official narratives that challenge negative stereotypes associated with financial and political consequences of the revolutionary violence. At the World Fair, many exhibits were put on by artists and intellectuals from Mexico, including indigenous art that looked back at Mexico's indigenous heritage, and also replicas of Mexican villages to encourage visitors. As Moss writes, the displays at the World Fair, quote, committed Mexico to popular memory, end quote. Clearly, the goal after the revolution was Mexico's creation of a new modern identity. In an article titled The Frivolous Scene, Paulina Suarez Hesketh reveals how other places in Mexico were committed to shaping a new identity other than established government regulated and funded artists at World's Fairs. For example, quote, economic and political volatility of the 1920s and the lack of a stable middle class, end quote, created new audiences for theaters to put on unique shows based on real life, and dances became oversexualized in the eyes of many. Clearly, Mexico was ripe for new ideas, and people were creating a Mexican society to fit their needs after a bloody revolution. So after the Mexican Revolution, Mexico's identity was being shaped on two fronts. There was an external, outward-facing attempt to create their identity and show it off to the world, like seen at the 1933 Chicago's World Fair. But also, in the streets of Mexico City and around the country, Mexicans were understanding how to use their own heritage among their own peers and with other citizens, how to understand their lives and create an identity for themselves based on theater, dance, but also baseball and sport was another frivolous scene for identity creation. But to understand how baseball shaped Mexico's identity and how Mexicans used baseball to shape their identity, we have to rewind to before the Mexican Revolution to see what sports' role were in Mexico. Before the next segment, how about a little trivia? Which Mexican-born baseball player has hit the most home runs? I'll give you a little time to think about that one, and we'll check out the answer in a little bit. From 1876 to 1911, during Porfirio Diaz's reign as president over Mexico, many things happened to shape Mexico's identity, including the use of sports. According to David Lefevre, in an article titled Prize Fighting and Civilization in Mexico, Public Sphere in the 19th Century, Diaz and his administration, quote, sought to import foreign ideas, technologies, and cultural practices to remedy what they perceived as a backwardness. Somehow, boxing was both a source of backwardness and remedy. Diaz loved to host boxing matches, and, in a quote from Lefevre, elite families in the presence of the president did not constitute a risk to morals or an increase of barbarianism as feared by Diaz on other occasions. Those other occasions of boxing were the risk of U.S. uncontrollable violence penetrating across the border and corrupting Mexico's population. Diaz even put bounties out to stop illegitimate and underground boxing matches as they were, quote, under attack from modernity. However, the paradox here is Diaz still used boxing and other sports for his goal of shaping Mexico. Boxing was taught to youth, and the YMC encouraged boxing as to increase the physical culture of Mexico. Boxing and bullfighting both revealed an athletic separation of classes, because if you were doing it on your own, without the supervision of Diaz, or not in an organized place like the YMCA, then it was outcast and seen as a danger. However, if you were buddy-buddy with Diaz and could go to a personal boxing match or could afford the boxing training, you were seen as higher up in society. Joseph Arbena, in Sport, Development, and Mexican Nationalism, argues sports during the Porfiriato created a bigger separation of classes between what Arbena deems as the white elite and the darker elements of society. Clearly, sport did not welcome every aspect of society before the Mexican Revolution. But how did sport affect Mexican society after the revolution? According to Arbena, there was a failure of the post-revolutionary government in Mexico to use sport differently than the Porfiriato, and sport accomplished some slight goals due to, quote, ignorance, bad faith, and lack of responsibility. Arbena feels that sport after the revolution was only to increase society's image and the Mexican identity on the surface. Just like Porfiriato, they cared about the image and not really about the athlete. For example, Arbena reveals how athletes were sent to the Olympics in Paris and Amsterdam But even though they didn't do well, Mexico didn't care. All they cared about was that they were being sent to the Olympics in general. However, not all authors agree with Arbena. Keith Brewster, in his article Redeeming the Indian, argues sport was successful in creating a wider, more accepting identity for Mexico that included more than just the upper class. Brewster provides examples of the 1932 National Sports Confederation, which, quote, looked to accomplish the highest duty the Constitution asks of our youth. Also, in 1941, Revolution Day was celebrated, and the government encouraged playing indigenous sport to celebrate Revolution Day. So clearly, more than just elites were included in a countrywide effort to use sport to create a new identity in Mexico. One sport that was instrumental in helping Mexico shape their identity after the revolution was baseball. Before we move on to the next segment, how about the answer to the trivia question? Which Mexican-born Major League Baseball player hit the most home runs? The answer is Vinny Castilla, who hit 320 Major League homers. The two-time All-Star had a 16-year career and had a stretch from 1995 to 1999 where he played for the Colorado Rockies and he hit 191 home runs, an average of 38 dingers a season. The beginning of baseball in Mexico is very hard to track. However, it's also very hard to track in the United States as well. According to John Thorne in his book called Baseball in the Garden of Eden, bat and ball games are portrayed in hieroglyphics. There are English poems describing something that resembles baseball dating way before Abner Doubleday. It's most likely that the retired Civil War veteran did not create baseball in a field in Cooperstown, New York. However, the search for baseball's beginning is actually filled with lies and unknown truth. Personally, I like it that way. But just like baseball's Hall of Fame is in Cooperstown, where baseball is supposedly to have begun, Mexico's Hall of Fame is in Monterrey. And that is where some people think baseball was first played, in Mexico. According to several authors, like Matt Rothenberg at the Baseball Hall of Fame or Jesse Sanchez at 1800baseball.com, from a period of 1870 to 1890, railroad building and Mexican-American War was the source of baseball spreading to the United States. A historian and history professor at CSU Channel Islands, Jose Alamillo, had a more definitive answer to how baseball spread to Mexico. It came through Cubans escaping to Mexico and teaching the game to people in Mexico. I see it as all of these can kind of combine to be the source of baseball's history in Mexico, and even though there's no official beginning, it is still nice to have many different stories and a lot of different parts of the country able to share in the beginning of baseball in Mexico. Jose Almilo writes a lot about the beginning of baseball in Mexico, but also focuses on Mexican-American baseball, which we'll get to in a little bit. Almilo describes how the Porfiriato saw baseball as the potential to create better citizens and better workers. He even instituted softball for women at the YWCA. Almilo writes that baseball teams were encouraged to be formed at factories and in companies in order to, quote, improve health and to prepare the workers for 10-hour workdays, 6 days a week, and arduous, back-breaking labor and pack-housing work. In other words, baseball served as a solution to helping companies create better workers. However, baseball quickly became more than a game. Even though Alamillo's evidence supports Arbena's claim that sport after the revolution really didn't accomplish much more than sport did in the Porfiriato, that is, to increase the lives of elites and help shape their identity in Mexico rather than touching the lives and the identities of every citizen. There is a lot of other evidence from baseball in Mexico that supports my claim that baseball in Mexico shaped the identity of the entire nation and not just the elites and a handful of people in the country. As we will see, baseball was instrumental in national development and international interaction for Mexico. In June of 1925, the Mexican Baseball League, created by Alejandro Reyes and Ernesto Carmona, played their first organized game in Mexico City. The events and life of the Mexican Baseball League revealed national development and international interaction in Mexico. First, the players in the Mexican League reveal a lot about Mexico as a country. According to baseballhistorian.com, Satchel Paige and James Cool Papa Bell played in Mexican League because of the better conditions than the United States for African-American baseball players. Not only did Paige and Cool Papa Bell play in the Mexican League, many Negro League players came across the border to play in the better conditions before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. Really quickly, according to the Society for American Baseball Research, Satchel Paige kept his own stats, but records he pitched in over 2,500 games, and while playing against Major League barnstorming teams, recorded 22 strikeouts a game, which would definitely be a record. And also, Paige's personal record reveals he threw 20 to 330 no-hitters. I'll take the over on that. Regardless of how many no-hitters Satchel Paige threw, he is clearly one of the best pitchers in baseball history. And the fact that Mexico was home to some of Paige's some 2,500 games is a real testament to the conditions in Mexico, because they were better at treating African Americans at that time in the United States. That shows the world how ahead of the United States Mexico was. Another baseball Hall of Famer that played in the Mexican League was James Cool Papa Bell. Satchel Paige said, according to the Baseball Hall of Fame, one time, Cool Papa Bell hit a line drive right past my ear. I turned around and saw the ball hit him sliding into second. Also, Satchel Paige tells a story that Cool Papa Bell could turn the lights out and be in bed before the room got dark. And while that sounds like an exaggeration, some of the places that Negro League players had to stay in the United States were not the best conditions, and there was a short circuit in the lights. So it took a couple of seconds for the lights to shut off after turning the switch. So there is some truth to Satchel Paige's story about Cool Papa Bell getting into bed before the lights turned off. Regardless, Cool Papa Bell is one of the best baseball players in history, just like Satchel Paige. And the United States lost out on a lot of Satchel Paige's and Cool Papa Bell's career because of the societal advancements in Mexico. So by having the Mexican League and welcoming in African-American players who should have been playing in Major League stadiums but couldn't because of the racist Major League Baseball, the world was shown that Mexico is an advancing society and welcoming and ahead of the United States in race relations. Not only did the Mexican League show the world how advanced they were socially, but also how they were ahead of the United States in labor, even with something as public as Major League Baseball. In Major League Baseball, teams had control of a player because of the famous reserve clause, or I should say infamous reserve clause, that nearly kept a player under contract for a team for their entire life unless a team wanted to get rid of them. According to an article from the Brooklyn Eagle in 1946 titled "Yank Court Case May Boomerang in Mexican Row," Mexican League was bringing MLB to court over the reserve clause, and it showed the United States and the world the monopoly and how awful Major League Baseball treated their players. Jorge Pascal, one of the owners of the Mexican League in the 1940s, was trying to get players from Major League Baseball, but he'd have to pay a pretty penny because any player that played in the Mexican League would be breaking the contract and the reserve clause in the major leagues and were subsequently banned for life. The reserve clause wouldn't be challenged until 1969 when St. Louis Cardinal Curt Flood unsuccessfully brought Major League Baseball to court suing for the reserve clause. The reserve clause wouldn't be removed until 1981 when Marvin Miller and the Players Union went on strike in 1981. Yes, that's Fernando Mania, and created free agency. Regardless, the Mexican League helped begin to open the eyes of the world that the way Major League Baseball was doing business was a monopoly, and things were going to be done a lot more democratically in the Mexican leagues. So, to pair with their race relations that were better than the United States, Mexico also flaunted a better society for players to play baseball. So they were showing the world how advanced Mexico was, and they were no longer a little brother to the United States. Instead, they were a direct competitor. And that is revealed by another Brooklyn Eagle article from 1946, written on April 1st, that a lot of Giants fans probably wish was an April Fool's joke. The article was titled, "Latest Mexican Raid Upsets Giant Morale." Sal Magley, a future 23-game winner in the major leagues, and two other Giant players decided to go to the Mexican League. This scared Major League Baseball, and it showed the rest of the majors that many stars in the league, like Magley, were deciding to go play in the Mexican League. So now, not only were Negro League stars playing south of the border, but players were deciding to throw away their major league career just to go play in Mexico for more money, and in some cases, better conditions, and for more democratic contracts that weren't tying players to one team for life. Not only were the New York Giants losing players to Jorge Pascal in the Mexican League, but also one of the most famous baseball owners in Branch Rickey. Rickey is famous for deciding to have Jackie Robinson play and break the color barrier in the National League. However, years before, in 1942, he had to pay one of his young stars, Mickey Owen, $60,000 to come back from the Mexican League, according to a Brooklyn Eagle article. And then, a few years later, in 1946, he had to save Pete Reiser and Stan Rojek from becoming, quote, Mexican jumping beans, and paid an increase in salary to have them stay in the United States instead of going to the Mexican League. So it took Jorge Pascal in the Mexican League trying to take players from the United States to get these players payment, not really what they deserved, because they were still being underpaid, but substantial pay increases to keep them from going to the Mexican League. Clearly, there was a competition, an international interaction with Mexico and the United States because of baseball, which helped shape Mexican identity as, one, a place with better race relations, two, a better place for baseball players to play, so a more progressive place for labor, and kind of acting as a way to help major leaguers get paid more money. So contrasting the playing conditions and the salaries in Mexico to the United States, Mexico seemed a lot better than the major leagues. And the only way that Major League Baseball and Branch Rickey was able to keep their players from going to Mexico was to pay them higher salaries. Even though Jorge Pascal's Mexican raids and idea of taking major league players away from the United States ended up going bankrupt, his willingness to pay players like Luis Olmo show the national development, and for a time, made the United States and others realize that Mexico did have some national development. According to an article in the Brooklyn Eagle, Dodgers are viewing the outlaw Mexican League with alarm. So, even though the Mexican League eventually did have to bend the knee and become an affiliated league to the Major League Baseball, owners in the Major League Baseball had to take the Mexican League seriously, and that revealed national development of Mexico. Even the Yankees were scared of the Mexican League. In 1946, reports of Phil Rizzuto and Snuffy Sternwest going to the Mexican League scared the New York Yankees. And there were also ideas that Ted Williams could leave. Someone even forged a Stan Musial letter saying he was going to go play down below the border. But not only did Musial say that that's not true, but his signature was spelled wrong at the end of the article. In the end, MLB had to settle and make the Mexican League an affiliated league to prevent more players from jumping and to stop the bad publicity that the Mexican League was creating, like with the monopoly that Major League Baseball had over its players and the race relations that Major League Baseball lacked, and as they missed out on the careers of Satchel Paige and Cool Papa Bell. And also, the Mexican League was costing Major League owners a lot of money as they had to give pay increases to players to not go to the Mexican leagues. Major League Baseball and the Mexican leagues were not the only things that helped baseball create an identity for Mexicans. According to Jesse Sanchez at 1800 Baseball, after the Mexican Rays settled down, a young Little League team from Monterrey, Mexico, put Mexico back on the map for baseball. Now called the Little Giants and recognized in the Baseball Hall of Fame, the 1957 Little League team became the first international Little League team to win at the Little League World Series. And also, pitcher Angel Macias threw a perfect game as Monterrey defeated California. When Macias and his teammates returned back to Mexico, they were treated as national heroes. Macias said, quote, "A majority of us came from economically disadvantaged areas, but a lot of doors opened for us immediately. For example, high school and college scholarships came in for Macias and his teammates." So, clearly, all ranges and specters of society were being positively affected by Mexico. Henry Pacheco at La Vida Baseball said that the Little Giants were a source of inspiration as the underdogs won in the United States. This contrasts Arbor's point that we talked about earlier, that sport didn't accomplish anything more than it did during the Porfiriato. Clearly, not only elites were benefiting from Mexico and helping it shape their identity, but also Little Leaguers were being put into baseball pantheon that came from, as Macias said, economically disadvantaged areas, and were remembered in baseball forever. Another important person in Mexican baseball was Hector Espino, who was nicknamed the Babe Ruth of Mexico. He hit anywhere from 755 to 796 home runs. St. Louis signed him, and he only played 32 games in Jacksonville, according to La Vida Baseball. Espino returned to Mexico and was regarded as a hero for embracing baseball in Mexico. In an article titled "Mexico, Baseball's Humble Beginnings," written by Jorge Iber, Espino felt there was, quote, "nothing unfortunate about staying in Mexico. He embraced the baseball of his own nation, and in doing so, rejected the notion that Mexico was some kind of little brother. This shows to the entire country of Mexico that they belong on a national and global scale to be recognized, and this pairs with a lot of the other evidence we just looked at that show Mexico had national development that they could be proud of because of baseball. And baseball helped show Mexicans that, which in turn created their identity. And finally, even though we're focused on baseball in Mexico, it is important to realize baseball was a part of Mexican-American lives as well. We already talked a little bit about Alamillo's research, but Alamillo reveals that the first California-Mexican-American baseball club in California was created in 1933, and it, quote, served as a vehicle for Mexican community cultural expression, wielding organizational ties and strengthening social bonds. The Corona Athletics was a team of all Mexican-Americans, and they played in a league against the Exchange Lemon Byproducts, a team of all white players. When the Athletics faced off against the Byproducts, the play on the baseball field, quote, represented struggle over race, class, and masculine pride. So clearly, baseball was a big part of how Mexican-Americans understood their part in society in America. In Indiana Harbor, Chicago, John Frain remembers that local baseball helped shape Mexican identity because the teams made their culture visible and that they were Mexican by playing in uniforms that had Mexican names on them. By playing every week, Mexicans on the baseball field had a sense of community, as the whole Mexican-American community would come out each week to watch them play. And therefore, baseball helped Mexicans hold on to the identity baseball created in a new country in the United States. On the whole, baseball is as important to understanding Mexican identity as the exhibits at the 1933 World's Fair, dance and theater, and nightlife in Mexico after the Revolution, and other mainstream areas of study in Mexican history. Not only do the superstars like Angel Macias and Fernando Valenzuela reveal the pride and global impact of Mexican baseball, but the international interactions of Jorge Pascal and the Mexican League show how Mexico placed itself and understood the impact of Mexico after the Mexican Revolution. Nowadays, soccer is Mexico's national sport. While Latin American baseball players are the superstars in Major League Baseball now, Mexico doesn't produce the same number of talent. However, Adrian Gonzalez, a former Major League Baseball player, was born in the U.S., but lived in Mexico for parts of his childhood. He still holds on to his Mexican heritage, and according to an ESPN article in 2017 by Doug Padilla, Gonzalez is the most popular athlete in Mexico, even more than any Mexican soccer player. Baseball in Mexico is still celebrated, with games being played in Monterrey and minor league baseball celebrating Mexican culture with the Copa de la Diversión in its third season, where minor league teams wear Mexican-themed uniforms and change their names and identities to the Avocados, Cocos Locos, Manzanas Luchadores, and other fun mascots and logos to celebrate Mexican heritage. While those make for great, unique hats to add to collections and a fun night at the ballpark, they're also important in remembering the importance and impact of baseball in Mexico as a sport that helped Mexicans shape their identity after the Mexican Revolution, as understanding that Mexico was a part of the global economy and part of global interaction, and also showing the world that Mexico was nationally developed. And when baseball players and other people in Mexico saw that pride in baseball players like Angel Macias coming home after throwing a perfect game and being a hero, or Major League superstars coming across the border to play in Mexico, or seeing how scared Major League Baseball was of the Mexican League, all culminate together to make Mexicans proud to be Mexican and to share in such a beautiful sport as baseball. Baseball truly helped Mexico shape their identity and understand themselves as Mexican, thanks to Angel Macias, Jorge Pascal's work with the Mexican League, and African-American players deciding to come to play in Mexico. That is the end of my argumentative part of this podcast, revealing how baseball helped shape Mexico's identity after the revolution. However, as mentioned in the beginning, John O'Dell now joins the podcast to talk a little bit about Mexico and baseball and the exhibit he helped create at the Baseball Hall of Fame called Viva Mexico. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this interview. I'm now joined by John O'Dell, and he is the curator of history and research at the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, and he's worked there for over 20 years. He developed the Viva Baseball exhibit at the Hall of Fame. So, John, thanks for coming on.
Happy to be on, Tim. Thanks for inviting me.
So why don't you tell me and the listeners a little bit about what the goal and the purpose of having that exhibit at the National Baseball Hall of Fame is?
Sure. And first, I want to tell you that whenever anybody is ascribed, especially at the Hall of Fame, but this is true in a lot of places with the person who was, you know, did the exhibit, it's sort of like being the field general of a big group of people. It's a big project, uh-huh. And it's a big cooperative project. It included, so I was curatorial, but included collections management, included the library, included exhibits and the design departments. We worked with our public relations and development people. So, you know, it's all across the board when you're doing mm-hmm. a major exhibit like this. What we wanted to do with baseball, Latin baseball, the Latin baseball story, began even before I got to the Hall of Fame in 1999. When I got to the Hall of Fame in 1999, the hall had just opened up Pride and Passion, the story of African Americans in baseball. That opened in 97. That was the 50th anniversary of Jackie Robinson. And it was immediately recognized that the next big story ought to be the Latino story. And so I got there, and that was what one of the things my boss said was, we're going to be doing the Latino story next. Well, it was 15 years later before we did the Latino story, because it took that long for us to get to naturally and slowly develop a good sense, a good historical sense of what we wanted to do with this very broad and very deep and surprisingly complex and nuanced story. That is, the more we got into it, the more we realized there's so much more there than simply Juan Marichal, Fernando Valenzuela, mm-hmm. and Carlos Delgado. You know, it's like, yeah. You know, you could, we wanted to do more than just like, oh, here are the highlight Latin players. Can you imagine baseball without Big Poppy? Oh, no, I can't imagine baseball without Big Poppy. So what we wanted to do was to tell the stories of each individual country, which we do when you first walk in. It's overlaid. There's a map of the Caribbean, scale map of the Caribbean that you walk on, and you get a chance to see how central Cuba is to the Caribbean and how close Cuba is to everything in the Caribbean. And the Cubans, as you may know already, were very much the apostles of baseball, carrying it all around. And so what we wanted to do is tell each of the stories of each of the Latin countries where baseball is king, basically, it's big, and then tell the stories of first how they're different, how they're the same, and then the bridge that baseball served to take baseball players from their home countries, homelands, to the United States, where they eventually made it big. So, and then we finish up with modern Latin baseball players. And now, can you imagine what it would be like? But that's how I got started.
So, what do you think the biggest challenge was besides the scope of creating an exhibit like this?
Well, one of the biggest things was we decided fairly early on that we wanted to go do it bilingually. And that's just really difficult when, you know, we don't live in New York City. You know, we don't have access to a lot of native speakers. And we don't have any native speakers on our staff. And so there's an element, this is the toughest thing, there is an element of trust that you have to develop. And we thought we had the right person and ultimately did not. And we've been working since then to clear up some of the translations. They're fine. They're grammatically correct, but they're a little stilted. They don't flow the way they ought to. They don't flow the way they do in English. And that's that you realize, oh, there are people who are translators, not just people who know baseball and know Spanish, even if they're native Spanish speakers. There are people who are translators, and that's why it's a profession. I would say, in addition, just trying to give the richness of baseball down in the Caribbean. People call baseball our national pastime, and it is. And those who've studied history know it used to be much bigger because it was, you know, hockey and basketball and football and golf and auto racing and everything all rolled up into one. And that's really the way it is still down in the Caribbean. And so, always the best athletes are going out for baseball. That doesn't happen in the United States anymore.
Yeah.
You know, always, if there's a choice between going out to a baseball game and doing something else, people go to the baseball game. And the passion, I got a chance to go to a couple of Dominican League games, the passion of the fans down there, just nonstop. And the thing that I will, that most embodied that was how in an American game, you go and everybody's cheering and whooping and hollering and everything like that. And the pitcher gets the ball back and everybody gets quiet for the pitcher to throw because, you know, maybe the pitcher can't think if somebody's yelling at him, or maybe the batter can't think. In the Dominican, the whooping and hollering continues for 9 straight innings. It does not stop. It doesn't stop in the game. It doesn't stop. And the attitude there is, you can't concentrate when I'm yelling and hollering and whooping for you, then you don't belong here.
Yeah.
So being able to convey that kind of joy, was one of the things that we really wanted to do.
What do you think the most unique item in the exhibit is?
I think, we got from, the family of Hector Espino. Hector Espino is the Babe Ruth or Hank Aaron of Mexico. And we got his jersey from his from a close family friend that he had worn when he was the manager of the Naranjeros. And so we got a chance to tell the story of Hector Espino, who, because he came from Mexico, could bounce between the Mexican League and the Mexican Pacific League, playing summer baseball and winter baseball all year round. And he had, I think it was like 34 games or something like that. The Cardinals drafted him. And he came up to Jacksonville, Florida, and said, "They don't talk like me. They don't eat like me. They don't like me. It's 1964. I'm considered a Negro to them, and they hate Negroes. I'm going back home, and I can." Mm-hmm. And so that was a great opportunity to talk about what Mexico offered to baseball players that was not available to them in other places.
Yeah, I touch on that in my research, like with Satchel Paige and Cool Papa Bell, but also a lot of players played there in the winter.
Yes.
Like they would go down, and I forgot the name of one player, but he actually had to go under an alias to play in Mexico because his manager wouldn't let him play. But what do you think would happen, or what would the reaction would have been if Ted Williams or Stan Musial decided to jump into the Mexican League during the quote unquote Mexican raids?
Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, there were a lot of very good players who did end up going down there. I think that ultimately they would have had the same ban on them, the quote unquote lifetime ban, which all of them had, which was then forgiven. I think that the problem that the Mexican raid had was that it was just underfinanced. You know, it really did not have a chance of succeeding. What it really did more as much as anything else also was show how major league owners were so horribly underpaying their players even mm-hmm. back then. And in that way is a foreshadowing in ensuing decades of Marvin Miller and the need for a real union.
So backtracking a little bit, what place does the 1957 Little League team and Angel Macias have in the exhibit?
Oh, we've got him. We got him. Yes, we have the little giants, the pequeño gigantes yeah. pequeños. Hold on for a second. I've got my script here. What I'm going to do after we finish, I'm going to send you a copy of our Viva Baseball script. So you'll have a digital copy of that.
Okay.
It will be helpful for you. Let's see. Yeah, so we have a photo of the team, and we tell a little bit about the team as being the first international team to win it. And, you know, of course, if you've gotten a chance to see the movie, it's just marvelous. Have you seen it?
No, I didn't know there was a
movie. Yeah, they've made a movie about I think they're called the Little Giants.
Uh-huh.
So, and it's a wonderful, it talks about how difficult it was for them to make it across and to, you know, get all the issues that were going on. But back in the 1950s, Louisville Slugger provided created bats for the Little League champions, and they did it into the 60s and 70s and maybe even later than that. But we have a bat from them commemorating the Little League World Series championships from Monterrey, Mexico, and has everybody's signature engraved into it. So they all had to write their names, and then it got engraved into it. And so we have Angel Macias' name there, and we spun the bat so that you can see his name.
That's awesome. Do you have a favorite Mexican ball player that some people may not know about that you'd like to get the story out of? You know, obviously there's Macias and Espino and Valenzuela, but what about some other players who may not get too much attention?
You know, one of the early baseball players was in America called Bobby Avila. He was called in the United States Bobby Avila. He was actually Beto Roberto or Beto Avila. So, and he ended up, he was one of the early major league stars. He debuted in 1949, wasn't the first guy to come from Mexico, but he was the first one to kind of make an impact. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure he got at least one batting title. I would say he's probably the one that I would say, oh yeah, he's one more guy that you should know. But really, I think Fernando Valenzuela and Hector Espino are two of the really big guys. I will also say that Adrian Gonzalez lived both in California. He was born in the United States, lived in California and Mexico, and he ended up representing Mexico in both the Caribbean Series and then the World Baseball Classic. So one more of those kinds of things. And, you know, one of the oddities of looking at background and nationality and genealogy is that Ted Williams' mother was Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
But because the family did not identify at all as Hispanic or Latin, that's why he is generally left off of these kinds of, who's Latin and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
born in the United States, apparently had no connection to his Latino roots. His mother apparently did not either. And so, you know, forewent those. And so it's a great way to understand the problem of when you start talking about individuals. Mm-hmm. It's like, who is what and who determines that? And that's a very difficult situation to get in. You're much better off talking about Mexico, mm-hmm. what happens in Mexico, and what happens when players who were born in Mexico come to the United States.
Yeah.
One of the things that I do have for you, I think that's really great, is there's a great quote by Willie Wells, who is a Negro League star shortstop. And he said that, I found freedom and democracy here, something I never found in the United States. Here in Mexico, I am a man.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really cool. That was 1944. So, you know, that's a neat example of that.
Yeah, doing this research, there's obviously a lot more than what the casual fan would ever come across. Why do you think Mexican baseball and maybe the Mexican raid is kind of understudied or under talked about as much?
Yeah, I think it's because it failed ultimately in doing what it wanted to do. And in the same way that we really don't talk too much about the Federal League, going back into the 19th century, the Union League and the Players Leagues, it's like mm-hmm. these little blips that come along, but Major League Baseball was such a monopoly that it just had the economic weight to just smush you.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you were a molehill in the way of the steamroller MLB, you were going to get squashed. And I brought up Marvin Miller earlier. I bring him up again now because it talks about how what Miller was able to do in order to counteract, you know, over 100 years of that kind of thing and turn the baseball players themselves into their own union. And that was his great quality, was he wasn't trying to do it from the top down, mm-hmm. but figured out how to do it from the bottom up so that all of the ball players understood what their best interest was and how to achieve that.
Yeah, Marvin Miller, he deserves a lot more attention. It's good he finally got in. But
yeah.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about all this. Today, as we record this interview, there's a virtual tour of the Viva Baseball exhibit. But what other opportunities are there to learn about baseball and interact with the Hall of Fame, even though we're in quarantine?
Really, we have a whole program called Safe at Home, which you'll find when you go to our website. And we have made, we're producing a lot more shareable, exchangeable, fun, entertaining and engaging pieces online so that, you know, wherever you are, and I think that a lot of this is going to continue, but wherever you are, you'll be able to get at least a little bit of your picks. So that's what's going on here.
All right. Awesome. Thank you very much, and stay safe.
And hey, Tim.
Don't forget about Mexico.
From the windows filled with indecision, I get good advice from the iPhone.